So now I tell you something about Rizal, which I got together with Harry on the role of fifth order in RNA folding. So now we go from DNA to RNA. I would consider that still a widely open subject. I sort of just give you some ideas which I had about that. It's far from being a solution. I organize things like that. I first, in order to study what happens with this order the same way as the hamlet, we have to study what happens without this order first. Then we look at a small disorder, in which case we can look at the trioptica calculation. Then we go to a strong disorder. I show you some numerical results, and at the end, some simple picture, which may describe what you see in the numerical, which is actually modeled after what the hamlet just said. Okay, so let's start to understand sequences without disorder. That's actually a very old idea. Dejean already proposed it in 1968. Why don't we look at sequences like that, AU repeats or GC repeats? And while these things have a nice feature, that however you put them together, they like to stick to each other and don't really have any translational information. So we can model that in the way I showed it to you this morning. Just the interaction matrices become much easier. We have only one interaction parameter. For every contact, we gain some energy epsilon zero. And we will limit ourselves to the regime where this interaction is strong enough that we don't have any big loops. So we don't deal with all these loop entropies or anything like that. And then we have no energetics in our problem. So all that is left is entropy. Entropy in this case is just branching entropy. The fact that if we just take a RNA of a certain length, this can have all sorts of different structures which are all energetically the same as long as they have the same number of bonds. And so we would expect a coexistence between all of those. That's of course mathematically very nice. We have this Hartree equation here. The partition function becomes translationally invariant, so it doesn't depend on I and j anymore, but instead only on the length. So this thing you can Laplace transform, for example, in order to get rid of this sum over k on the right hand side. It becomes a quadratic equation, and just written down here in Laplace space, everybody knows how to solve a quadratic equation. So you get the Laplace transform partition function, and you can back transform it. And what you find is this characteristic behavior. The partition function of the system goes like n to the minus 3/2 times something non-universally extensive. And this goes back to Dejean. And in the bioinformatics community, actually Waterman, we discovered the same thing 10 years later. And a much easier way to see that, and that makes use of this mountain representation which I showed you. Remember, every RNA secondary structure corresponds one-to-one to a mountain. We do not have any energy here, so all we have to do is we have to count how many structures we have, counting how many structures we have, and counting how many mountains we have. And a mountain is something which can at each step go up or down horizontally, so it's a random walk. It's nearly a free random walk. There's just the condition that you can never go below zero, so it's a free random walk in the presence of a wall. And what you're looking at is curves which come back at the end, so you have to calculate the return probability of a free random walk in the presence of the hard wall, and that of course gives you this n to the minus 3/2 behavior. You can also from that see some more things. You can, for example, ask yourself, well, what is sort of the size of a typical secondary structure in that business? As the size, we could, for example, define the following. We take the first base, and we take the base n over 2, the one in the middle, and then we ask, well, how many base pairs do we have to cross if we go from one to the other? That is sort of a measure of the size if you put this into a plane. And if you look at this mountain representation carefully, you can convince yourself that this is nothing else but the height of the mountain exactly in the middle, and therefore has this k length. Sort of a maybe interesting side remark. If you now think that this thing can coil up in three-dimensional space, no doubt of ones, then these arms, which have a length squared and themselves take space of square root of square root n, So we get an object which has a radius of gyration of n to the 1/4, and that is what is known for branched polymers if we don't have any cycle winds. And that's probably one of the simplest ways to actually derive that only by knowing about random walks. Another thing we can see from that, I mean, we know that there are all these hairpin cuffs and all these sort of things. These are only local changes to the rules of this random walk, and therefore, at least if you're interested in universal quantities, they should be irrelevant. Okay, so what happens now if we use randomness? So without randomness, everything is pretty easy. We now want to go towards randomness in sort of a perturbative way, so that we can think about is we still have this CGCGCG and plot in some, every now and then, some randomly chosen bases. Then it makes sense to write the interaction energy between base I and base J as still some average plus some deviation from that, and what we assume is that this deviation is some average small. Actually, I do some very crude approximation here and say that I assume that these guys here are all independent random variables with mean zero and with some fluctuation, the size of which is measured by delta epsilon. That's of course, at that point I neglect correlations. I mean, really what I should take a random sequence and calculate the interaction energies from the pairs of bases which I have. And that means I have n random variables. Here again, I basically say that all the n squared pairwise interaction energies are all independent random variables. So what I now want to know, basically, is does this order matter? Basically, what I expect, what could happen is that I could end up in a glass phase. If so, where is the phase transition temperature? So in principle, this order could be relevant. I could have a glass phase for all temperatures. This order could not make any difference at any temperature, and I could have the multi-phase down to zero temperature, or there could be a finite phase transition temperature between the glassy phase, where we have only one or a few structures which dominate the ensemble, and this multi-phase where everything basically contributes. How do we see the difference? Well, what we should do is look at two RNA sequences.
You say that in a glassy phase a few structures dominate? I mean, you could have many structures in a glassy phase, right? I would define a glassy phase by having many structures. Because then I don't really agree with what is written there.
What do you mean? I mean,
you can have frozen, very different structures. You could have many. I mean, this order can be important in a glassy phase. You would have.
Are you not talking about kinetic?
No,
kinetic,
I'm talking about static. Talking about spin glasses, but...
How many
children
they
between left and right? No, but I'm just asking, you don't know, right? You could have many... Why would you say that there are... Okay, I mean...
Okay, I guess that's the question, what you define to be a glass. I mean, a glass I would expect that you have basically one or a few very low energy structures and everything else is...
No, I would not. I'm not sure, you know. Okay, I would not expect that for the glass.
I guess then we're in trouble here with that.
Yeah, probably this detailed issue. Surely, let's say, in a spin glass, I would not expect it, right?
Right.
You agree on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then also in a, Then also in a spin glass, it's not very clear because I can have a confirmation in completely different structures.
You shouldn't have it. I mean, in the thermodynamic limit, you shouldn't have it extensively manual.
Yeah.
Isn't it a problem of vocabulary?
Yeah.
The statement that he says that these are important means replica work together.
Yeah, but without interaction.
Without interaction, just means that you have a non-trivial PFQ function, and we would agree that this is a problem.
Or not together in many, very different.
There could be many different ways for it to be solved. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Not together means not together being different. But then it's
still there could be many different ways in which there could be many different
I'll give an idea definition, but it's a stream,
obviously. Yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
He's not saying how many phases there are in this game. He's getting lost on that.
So in my view of things, what we should do is look at two replicas which have the same disorder and see if they basically completely take completely independent structures or if they will tend to take the same structures because they all see the same disorder. Okay. Unfortunately, of course, solving a disordered system is very difficult. So what we do is we say, okay, we do a weak disorder, and in weak disorder, the first term in the perturbation theory for low disorder is the two replica system. So we can look at the two replica system here and actually perform this on some leverage. You can perform this on some leverage for any number of replicas, and what you get is the following system. You have two replicas, each of which have a uniform interaction for themselves. Every base finds every other base equally well. And in addition, you have an inter-replica interaction, as usual when you do replica averaging, which gives you an extra energy delta epsilon for every common bond between the two replicas. So, for example, if we look at this pair of structures, we can count how many common bonds we have here. Base 1 and n are bound over here, and are bound over here. 2 and n minus 1, 3 and n minus 3. And if you actually count around here, you'll find that these are also the exact same base pairs in both sides. We have 7 of them. So this pair of structures would have whatever the weight for each of it by itself is, and then another extra energy of 7 delta epsilon. Okay. So this is now an effective system which we can look at, and the key to describing this is by ordering, so now we have to do the partition function, which is the sum over all the pairs of configuration, and we reorder this sum by first summing over all the configuration of the common bonds, and then summing over all the configurations of the non-common bonds. Of course, the common bonds specifically are bonds, so the sum, so a possible configuration of common bonds is itself a valid secondary RA structure. Okay, so we have the outer sum, which is the sum of all possible secondary RNA structures of the common bonds. Then, what is left? Well, what is left is the sum of the non-common bonds, but if this is the structure of the common bonds, we also know that we never will have a pairing between an unbound base in here and an unbound base in there. So the sum of the non-common bonds will actually factorize into individual sums for all these loops here. So these bubbles now just stand for the sum of all ways to put non-common bonds in the two replicas among these bases which the loop takes. What would we expect how this thing behaves? It definitely, of course, depends on the number of bases in this loop. And if we would have just one replica, then we know that the weight should go like the number of bases to the minus 3 half. If we just would sum over all configurations of two replicas, it should be the square of that, or added to the minus 6 over 2. And it actually turns out that the fact that we do not have say we should sum only over non-common bonds does not change that behavior. But that's a little bit more complicated to see. So you can think about this problem as effectively being a similar RNA molecule which fluctuates in six-dimensional space. Right? Just because these bubbles come with the fact that I do the minus 6 over 2. And that's exactly what we would get if we would consider the return probability of a walk in six-dimensional space. Just that this entropy here was purely generated by summing over the configurations of the non-common bond. It's not really some spatial degree of freedom, but we can think about it in that way. Now, people, of course, have been thinking about how to study homo RNA in some space, and from doing so, one can actually solve this problem exactly, which means you can write down the Laplace transform partition function again. And also give a reason why it should be, why it doesn't matter that you sum of these non-common bonds. What you find is that you get a phase transition at some finite critical strength of the disorder, where if the disorder is smaller than that, the two replicas completely fluctuate independently, whereas if the critical disorder is larger than a critical disorder, then the two replicas basically orbit at the same context and are locked together. You can also calculate, if you want to, the specific heat exponent, which is 1, and that tells you that you are just on this borderline between the first order and the second order phase transition. One quantity you can look at is, for example, the fraction of common contacts, which is what you would sort of call the overlap of the two replicas. And what you see is that this behaves sort of strangely because as you, so on this axis we have the strength of the disorder, and here is the fraction of the common contact. That's just counting the number of common contacts divided by n over 2. And you see as you increase the disorder, this fraction continuously increases. So this fraction is not even zero if you have two independent RNA. But if you would follow this functional form, it actually would go through 1 at some point, which it obviously can't. And so what actually happens is that at this point you have a non-analyticity, and that's exactly the phase transition.
Excuse me, what is the Monte Carlo simulation, the simulation of?
Right, it is also of this very same
model. Of the two replicas.
But
if you solved it exactly, why do you need the simulation?
Just to show you that my exact solution is indeed correct. I have to convince myself that the exact solution is correct. So what we conclude from that is that we indeed in the two replica system have a finite critical disorder, and therefore that we can be conclude that the disorder is determinatively irrelevant in the modern phase, since that is the first order term we should have looked at.
So the phase transition here, what's the order parameter for this phase transition?
That's an excellent question. You mean anything which is zero below? And I don't know,
believe me.
That's a very good question. That's one of the things which I don't really know. I mean, I can tell you that there is a non-analyticity in the energy and the...
This is the average of overlap that you are plotting here.
Right.
So in the molten phase, in the thing that you call the molten phase before, you have a non-zero average overlap, that's it?
Yes.
So have you looked at PFU in this region? The probability distribution of this kind of thing?
No, I didn't. I mean, the point is this overlap changes as you change the interaction. I'm not sure.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, this is all just the two replica system, right? It's not a disorder. No, it's what you have after doing this order average.
The Monte Carlo is not the real
It's just the Monte Carlo of the two replica system. It doesn't have anything to do with the real disorder system. So this is all purely two replica system.
But so you're finding that this Q is non-zero in your in the phase that you define trivial, let's say.
Right.
Yeah. I'll understand that.
But basically, it's just the chances of an RNA molecule having close contacts is large enough, right? So, I mean, we have all bases bound, so some things have to be bound to each other, and typically things on short contacts are bound to each other. And what you find is that...
But if you take a paramagnetic IC model in the paramagnetic phase, spins have to be 0 or 1, right? 1 plus 1 or minus 1. Still, the P of Q will be something shrinking in 0. It is true. Be aware of that.
Well,
my question was, how does he understand that he finds a non-zero Q in what he considers a trivial trace?
Well, I mean, it definitely comes from these microscopic interactions. That's, I mean, if you just look at it, where the overlap comes from, but I don't know what additional explanation is good for that.
Can I ask you a question about the model? You assume that the delta epsilon ij's are Gaussian random.
Right.
If I look at the real energies and the real RNA, for example, well, what is the distribution of that?
Well, I mean, first of all, of course, we do have all these correlations, right?
Yeah.
Because originally the delta epsilon ij are calculated from the base pairs. Then, I mean, you only have a discrete number of interaction energies if you look at it microscopically.
Yes.
So, I mean, the hope is basically for a question like, is there a glass transition, is there not a glass transition, and these sort of things do not matter.
No, but I just wanted to know, just empirically, if I took the thing that you're modeling with the Gaussian independent microscopic assumption, if I took the real physical measurable energies, and what is the probability distribution?
We saw the table this morning. I mean, basically, if you take all bases with the same probability, all of that stuff comes up with the same probability. So, I mean, there were, what, 10 different values in there. So, I mean, it's a discrete value, but I don't know. So,
he's asking you, if you take the Gaussian disorder and you measure the real Q, not the true relative Q.
Or if I take
the real distribution.
Yeah.
That's what you asked?
Yeah. In one other way, it's the same thing. Yes. Well, you have to it's okay.
So the overlap is...
We discussed it later.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so now we know that, well, if we are at high temperatures, at some point the Morton description must be okay. Question is now, the other way around, is the glass phase stable? So do we have a finite temperature, or do we have to go to zero temperature? And there have been actually people who have been measuring...
Are you talking about the z-square
model? No, now I'm going back to the real random RNA model. Z-square is done now, but z-square... With z squared, we established that in weak disorder expansion, disorder is irrelevant. So now we want to look at strong disorder and basically numerically. And there have been actually numerical studies where people have been looking at the overlap distribution, now really doing random sequences and looking at the overlap of that. And in 1999, actually these were two CogMed articles which were within a month of each other, and then they sort of got spread out by the time they ended up in PIL. But they came to different conclusions. One said numerically, yes, there is a glass plate. The other said, no, there is no glass plate. So where did this come from? Okay, let me maybe skip over that. So what we've been doing in numerically is now in the spirit of this droplet picture, if you look at a free energy landscape like that, what we want to look at is at the scaling of the free energy difference between some excited state and some low energy state with a system size again, and excited state being something which looks really completely macroscopically different and it's not just a microscopic variation of the ground state. You can always just send two base pairs and not to hold up to your free energy, but what happens if you really have a macroscopic change? So this thing shifts dramatically according to the Traber theory. Scale like the system size is some power, if this power is positive, you're in a glass phase, if this power is negative, you're in the thermal phase. So how do we create these excitations? Well, what we do is we take the first base and we take the middle base and force those two to be bound to each other, give them a random sequence, but let all the rest re-optimize again. So what does that do for us? That sort of guarantees that we really get something which looks drastically different than what we started with at the ground state. On the other hand, because it is allowed to re-optimize here, you get something which is locally a minimum. And then we measure the free energy of this, and the free energy of the ground state, and take the difference and see how it scales the resistance size. If we would do it in the Martin phase, well, it's easy what we would observe. Since we know the partition function, we know the free energy, we can calculate the difference. We basically have just the strength of length n and two strands of length n over 2, and the difference turns out to be 3 half minus kT log n. So that's basically just the entropic loss of cutting this thing in the middle. If we go to low temperatures and average that over many sequences, this is the plot of actually this pinching free energy as a function of the system size, and it's a logarithmic scale down here, and what you see is that you get pretty much still a logarithmic dependence of this pinching free energy as a function of the system size. The prefactor is plotted over here. It's actually a prefactor minus 3 over 2t. So this should go to zero if we just would have the Morton phase. It does go to a finite value. That basically only still doesn't tell us if there's a phase transition anywhere here, but it at least tells us that at zero temperature there is something different happening. But let's go back to what we expected. We expected this thing should scale like some power of that, and if it's positive, it's glass. If it's negative, it's not a glass. Well, what we find is actually logarithmic behavior. So that means we are somewhere exactly on the marginality, and that explains probably why these numerical studies have such a hard time deciding on if there is a glass phase or if there is not.
You may say really t equals zero problem, right? Well, indeed, you have one more problem, because already for spin glasses, if t equals zero, you indeed have just one trivial p of q.
Right.
So it could be very well, and I don't know, probably it could be, but very slow you are restoring for very large lattices. If t equals zero exactly, the trivial p of q, while as soon as you get t different from zero, something different is happening.
You mean in the...
Yeah.
In the numerical studies?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but I mean they at least concluded that they have a
finite
temperature phase.
They could, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was T equals zero, right?
No.
What you were claiming in this paper, I believe, is that at T equals zero, the probability distribution of overlap was not trivial. And that could be not true, maybe.
No, right. The claim was really that there is a finite temperature glass transition. That was at least the of the Parisi group that claimed. So what we can learn from that is, well, it's hard to distinguish numerically, but at least even if it's a glass, but it's only a very weak glass. Right? We do not have any very, very high barriers here, and for practical purposes, there may be no differences between the molten and the glass. Right? That, because, I mean, you deal with only finitely long sequences, and that's then a question of just numbers, if log n fills the amount. So is there any way we can at least think about this logarithm? And there I can come back to what Lehan said. If you want to find a low energy configuration, you can use the following greedy algorithm. You take a sequence of length n, and now I basically shorter than the closed loop. It's easy to see that at least if you don't take loop entropies and things like that, it doesn't make a difference if it's a loop or not. Then you know from alignment that the highest energy matching region has an energy proportion to log n. We just saw that. This is Erdős-Rényi law. So you can just look around and find for the best matching piece. You do not even take into account yet that you are allowed to do these branches. Just if you look for the best matching linear piece, you know that the size of this best matching linear piece is of log energy log n and of length log n. Then you can match these two and then continue optimizing in these subgroups. That's, I will not give you the minimum energy state, but at least it gives you an idea of what these energies could be. If you, on the other hand, you do the pinching in advance, in the middle, then you a priori cut your system into two parts of length n over 2, and therefore the best matches which you find here are by a logarithmic factor smaller, and that could be a reason why you see this logarithmic dependence of these free energies. So let me just conclude. I hope that at least convinced you that if you don't have any disorder RNA, can be very easy, that for the low disorder case you can do this theoretical calculation and show that it's perturbatively irrelevant. For the high disorder phase, we have this numerically, this logarithmic dependence of the pinch free energy on the length of the sequences. Therefore, if there is a glass phase, which we still don't know, it's at least a very weak glass phase. But what we want to do here, obviously, it would be nice if I could do the n replica calculation or come up with some other analytical theory for the glass phase. One thing which has to be done is to actually go into the realistic RNA interaction parameters and see what the variables here now really are, and of course then finally one wants to know what the kinetics are to see, I mean, if anything is kinetically tracked, which is probably more important even for biology than if we have a thermodynamic path here.
Can you repeat your last argument? I mean, it seems like you've got a factor of log 2, but not, I mean, an energy difference which is constant, but not log 2.
Okay, what happened here? Well, if you write it down carefully, you do get a log, and maybe I didn't write it down yesterday night in the right way, I mean. Okay, you say your free energy as a function of n is something which is extensive and then something else. And what you want to calculate is f of n minus 2 f of n over 2, and you can approximate this f of n is
f1
of
n
log n,
and then you get.
Well, okay, I mean that I don't know yet, right?
But you're saying that f1 is actually this highest energy region.
Right, so I mean basically what I want to say now is that f of n is of the form something log n, because that's the highest energy region, and then plus f of some small n minus another constant log n, n minus. So I mean at some point somewhere is my best match, and then this is n, and this is n minus c log n, right? So, and okay, now the approximation you would like to do is say, well, this n is again most probably of the order of n over 2, and then the extensive parts in this difference, they should cancel out except for a long n thing, and the f1 parts, if you say, well, at least for the f1 part, I can assume that n is approximately n over 2, then the f1 parts also cancel out, and all you are left over with is this. Okay, right, this, I think the argument there, the way I wrote it down, the flaw here is that's not true. I mean, you get a log n thing here, and in addition to the log n thing, you still get the log n over 2 when you start optimizing the other halves. That was what, yeah, this obviously doesn't make any sense. Right, here you get only the 2 log n over 2s, but here you get the log n over 2 here, the log n over 2 here, and the log n thing here in the middle.
I really don't understand where your statement about saying that if there is a glass space, it is very weak. What does that mean? This criterion of pitching the two ends, it tells you something about what you have just written on the blackboard, which is a finite size correction to free energy or something like that. It doesn't tell you much about the glass space itself. And in particular, I don't see why it tests some rigidity. I mean, usually the exponent theta that you measure, spin glasses or something or whatever, it tests some rigidity of the place, and I don't understand why your procedure of pinching tests this rigidity.
So you object to the fact that the pinching creates a state which is completely independent of the...
I don't say that. I mean, precisely, when you want, it depends if you want to know, I mean, there might well be in a glass space some excitation control. Correspond to very different structure that have very similar free energy. And in this case, we have an exponent which is equal to zero. And this has nothing to do with the rigidity exponent that you measure by starting to twist boundary conditions and spin systems or something like that.
Okay, so, the problem is how it couples the order parameter with pinching.
Okay, so what you say is that this is too abrupt a change to do the pinching, but you said that...
Maybe there is something that is not sure in the interpretation.
I mean, the idea is really to sort of make sure that you get something which looks completely different from what the minimum state is, but which still...
What I just say is that from the scaling of this mean free energy with respect to the size, I don't see what you can deduce about the gas
problem. We probably should discuss about it later on. Okay.